Thank you, Randy. I'm excited to talk to you all tonight. I've talked to Ryan a couple times the last couple days, just as I've been trying to gather my thoughts about all of this. And it sounds like he's having a great time. He's been talking about David and Goliath and Leviathan and Pharaoh. And I've heard nothing but positive things about his time down there with the congregation where Richard Peterson's preaching at. Tonight we're going to be in Matthew chapter 22. I do want to start with a review just from the first two questions that were on the paper passed out Sunday, because I think it will be very applicable when we get into especially the first section of the questions that is asked of Jesus. So according to Matthew, per Ryan's review, who is Jesus?
Son of David.
Son of David, king. Who has come to do what, Jerry?
Who has come to bring salvation to the world.
Exactly. And how was he going to do it?
Through his death on the cross.
And through the through the good news of his sacrifice and glorification. Mm-hmm. I think Ryan's kind of gotten away from it. But at the beginning of this class, that was what he was getting us to repeat kind of as a mantra as we were going through, that Jesus was king who has come to redeem by proclaiming good news of his death and resurrection. And also to summarize the parables that we covered the last couple weeks, is there anybody who has just like an immediate thought about a good way to summarize the instructions Jesus was given through these three parables? The parable of the two sons. What was Jesus trying to get them to see in the son who responded in the end the right way?
I think he was trying to show them to be good stewards of the blessings that God had given them, that God had sent, you know, and they weren't being good stewards of that whatsoever. When the prophet showed up, you know, they killed them, and now the Son of God himself is there, and they're going to do the same thing to him. So they haven't been good stewards of the grace and the that God has sent.
Absolutely. Be fruitful. Be fruitful for the kingdom. That's especially the one instruction I got from the second one. Anybody else? Steve and Heath, I saw both of y'all were going to say something. You got anything else?
Well, overall, with all the parables, he's trying to teach them to speak with authority and recognize, to base their authority upon Jesus and his wisdom, teaching in a way that they're patient and wise in what they say and how they answer the questions that they give. He kind of did this many times by answering a question with a question, and most times he kind of put them into a dilemma, I guess you'd call it, to where, well, if I answer this way, this will happen. If I answer that way, that will happen. Yeah. When they were trying to trap him, he trapped them.
Right. Yeah, they're very... it's going to be very important coming into how Jesus deals with the questions as they try to entangle him with these propositions they make towards him. Go ahead, Heath, what were you going to say?
Yeah, well, I would summarize it along some of the same lines as Steve and Daniel have said. The Father is offering humanity a place in his kingdom where mankind can bear fruit that is lasting in eternity. And we see that the prideful reject it and the humble accept it.
Absolutely. Yep. Turn to God, be fruitful for his kingdom, accept his invitation and change your garments. That's really what I got from it. Turn to God, be fruitful for his kingdom and change your garments. So let's go ahead and read Matthew 22, 15 through 22. Matthew 22, 15 through 22. Randy, do you care to read? Or?
Okay. 15 through 22.
Yep, just that first section about Caesar, paying taxes to Caesar.
Then the Pharisees went and plotted how to entangle him in his works. And they sent their disciples to him, along with the Herodians, saying, "Teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God truthfully, and you do not care about anyone's opinion, for you are not swayed by appearances. Tell us then what you think. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" But Jesus, aware of their malice, said, "Why put me to the test, you hypocrites? Show me the coin for the tax." And they brought him a denarius. And Jesus said to them, "Whose likeness and inscription is this?" And they said, "Caesar's." Then he said to them, "Therefore render to Caesar's the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." When they heard it, they marveled, and they left him and went away.
So what is the goal and the intention of these Pharisees? And Steve pretty much summed it up for us earlier with his description for how Jesus handles their questions. But what are they trying to do in verses 15 through 17? What is their main objective with these questions?
I think they would love for him to say that you don't have to pay taxes to Caesar, because then they could pit the Roman government against him like dead on.
Right. And I think that's one answer they are hoping to get, especially from the religious authorities that are there. But concerning the other group, what are they hoping that they hear Jesus say? The Herodians, especially.
They do not have to pay taxes.
Or that they do.
That they do have
to pay taxes. Yeah, that they do have to pay taxes. The more secular authorities. And the Herodians would have been, you know, friends of the power of Rome, the political party of the time. And they would be somebody who sees their king as somebody who's come to redeem by proclaiming good news to his people. And so I think they are trying to get Jesus to just answer flat out with a yes or no. I think even in the way they pose the question, is it lawful or not? You know, it's just a yes or no. I want a yes or no answer. That way you are taking one of these two sides and we can turn half the people at least against you. So whether you say no and you turn off the religious authorities, the ones who thinks that, you know, it should all go to the temple, or you say yes and you turn off all of Rome's political party against you, either way, it's going to bring about your demise. And so I think that's really what they're trying to get Jesus to do. But like Steve said, he is miles ahead of them and knows perfectly how to face this test. And so one of the questions Ryan put on here was, you know, who else has put Jesus to the test throughout Matthew? Where else have we seen Jesus be tested throughout this gospel? It's come up several times. The chief priests and the Pharisees. Chapter 19, verse 3, the Pharisees came up to him and tested him by asking, "Is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause?" And back in 16, verse 1, the Pharisees and the Sadducees came to test him, and they asked him to show them a sign from heaven. And there's one other time at the very beginning of Matthew.
Chapter 4, tested in the wilderness by the devil.
So, yeah, it's Satan. Jesus asked Satan, "Why do you put me to the test?" It really highlights the, motivational force behind these people and their questions of Jesus and what they're trying to do to him. It's not that they really want an answer. It's that they are trying to bring him down and really just bring them to ruin.
There's also the Sadducees who did not believe in the resurrection. And they asked that question about the woman with the multiple husbands and whose wife would she be after the resurrection. And he just said, "You don't know the scriptures."
Right. Go ahead, Randy.
And my train of thought again in a second. So Jesus at some time likened them then to the children of the devil, right? Called them a brood of vipers.
Mm-hmm.
We see that that's come up to 26 and maybe hasn't happened yet. But he's saying, you're doing to me just what Satan would do to me.
Right. You're giving him power and authority over your life. You know, that's the ruling and reigning force that's causing you to act like this. Jerry, we're going to come back to the Sadducees and why it's important that they are the ones asking about the resurrection, because they're really trying to do the same thing here that the Pharisees and the Herodians are doing. It's just another group that is trying to entangle Jesus and to bring him down. And, you know, this like Brian's been emphasizing, this is the last week of Jesus's life. You know, he just humbly entered the capital city and is showing them how to live according to this new radical kingdom that's been, is being set up and inaugurated through his death and resurrection. And these groups especially are against what he is trying to do. So Jesus's answer in verses 19 through 22, Jesus, aware of their malice, knowing, you know, the intention and the cause of their questioning, knowing their malice, he asked, "Why do you put me to the test, you hypocrites?" And then he says, "Show me the coin for the tax." And they brought him a denarius. And Jesus said to them, "Whose likeness and inscription is this?" And they said, "Caesar's." Then he said to them, "Therefore, give back to Caesar the things that are Caesar, and give back to God's the things that are God's." So what is this little coin with a graven inscription that they're all carrying around in their pockets? In Jesus's mind, what is he comparing that graven metal image in their pockets? What's he comparing it to?
Are you going for idol?
An idol. Yeah, it's an idol that they're all carrying around in their pockets with somebody else's graven image and inscription on it. And so I think even their response, the way they says it's Caesar's, and you can see even in the way that our translators translate, you know, it's Caesar's, you can see the ownership in the, you know, the apostrophe S at the end of, it's not just like Caesar's on it, but no, that's Caesar's image. That's Caesar's coin. And he said, "Therefore, give back to Caesar the things that are Caesar, and give back to God the things that are God's." So what does that mean? What does that mean for us? And what does that mean for the people that he's trying to get to turn and be fruitful and change their garments? What is this teaching that Jesus has given all of us?
On the coin, it bears the image of Caesar, but we bear the image of God. And that's who our devotion goes to.
Absolutely.
So we shouldn't have, let's say, material things that we're so caught up in, whether we're giving back them correctly or we're trying to hold on to them tightly or whatever. Those shouldn't be our guide.
Mm-hmm.
Just give those back, you know, just let those go pretty much. Don't put your hope and your faith in them. I mean, we need some to live. I mean, but you just don't put your hope and faith in those. You're giving back to God, as Randy said, your whole life and commitment.
Absolutely. Totally agree with both of you. I think that is, I mean, that to me, that's what Jesus is telling us is God gets everything because you are created in his image. And so God gets it all. You give it all back to God. But if Caesar, you know, asks of you, one of his kingdom people, to give back to him the things that he owns, As long as you are still giving God everything, give it back to him. Give it back to him. And so, yeah, God demands our total allegiance. If we are created in his image, we have to give our entire self back to him. And when our nation state, our governing authorities require something of us that doesn't go against bearing the image of God, I mean, it's God saying you give that back to them. If how can we make that applicable to people who, we're living in an age and under a governing authority that we might not always agree with, that we may have, trouble reconciling how we can, pay taxes to a governing authority that we don't agree with, where that taxation is going towards. How do we live that out? How do we maintain kingdom citizenship while also giving back the things that are Caesar's to Caesar's to Caesar? Any thoughts?
Peacefully and quietly, yeah, comes to mind. Not making an unnecessary hardship for our own selves when we disagree with maybe a policy or a tax or some kind of civil authority that maybe rubs us the wrong way. We could respond to it in a way that brings attention to us. It's probably going to be negative, perceived by others as negative, or we can, like one of the epistles talks about, living quietly and peaceably with all men, but especially those who are in authority. And we don't have to agree with those things and necessarily support them, but we can have a stronger and better, more powerful influence by imitating the way of Christ. I could see Jesus saying here, like Paul said in Corinthians, imitate me as I imitate Christ. Jesus could have said in this passage, imitate me as I imitate my Father. And that's, I think, the better outcome.
I think you're all over it. And what I'm getting from it is that, no matter what Caesar calls you to do, you have to always respond in a way that Jesus will respond, which is never going to come with violence or hatred or anger or malice like they're coming at him with, but it's going to be peacefully laying down your life, if that's what it requires of you. Give back to God what is God, and let Caesar have what he owns, his property. Give it back to him. Go ahead, Randy.
Romans 13, Paul speaks directly to this, and starting verse 1 says, "Let every person be subject to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God, and those who exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval. For if he is God's servant, for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore, one must be in subjection, not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of convenience. So it also speaks here in the next verse, for because of this, you also pay taxes, for the authorities are ministers of God, tending to this rare thing. So part of our Christian duty, I remember a fellow that I worshiped with for many years, he said, you won't be a good Christian and be a bad neighbor. You won't be a good Christian and be a bad citizen. You know, like Keith said, you may not agree, but you need to live in such a way that you're deemed to be seen by others as a good example of just trying to help out government and not being flagrant and flippant and not respecting the positions that they hold.
Right. And I would even say in a way that is giving back to God what is God's, which is exactly how Jesus responded when others wanted to, you know, maliciously bring him down and attack him and crucify him. He didn't resist. He didn't. He peacefully laid down his life to show others who God is and how he acts.
And I think that these verses in Romans can tell us your respect is really to God. You're doing this because they're in position that God has given. You're not really trying to serve them or serve them, but you, this is your godly duty to be this. So,
yeah. No, it is. It's very, I mean, it is to me. Sorry, I'm not paying attention to the comments like Ryan does.
Sorry.
Eric, can you hear me?
Go ahead, Otis.
Yeah, okay. I'm following the conversation very well. Wow. Generally agreed. We were just wondering if you distill this particular question down to the idea of taxes rather than all other forms of support to the government, at what point does your Christian obedience outweigh the immoral use of taxes? That would be the question. Is there a point?
I would say give back to Caesar what is Caesar's and give back to God what is God's. If Caesar is requiring something, you know, if Caesar is requiring a tax of you, Benjamin Franklin of you, or Thomas Jefferson of you, you give that back to Caesar. You give it back to the government. But you don't do that at the expense of not giving back God what he's giving you, which is your whole life, which is your total allegiance, complete fidelity. You give that back to God. Does that answer it?
Yeah, sort of, but that puts it right back to the moral obligation of each individual. It would seem that we have to decide for ourselves on our journey of sanctification if there gets to be an obstacle in which the immoral behavior of the government directly offends my sensibilities as I understand them from the grace that's given me, then I have a deep decision to make. And it is an individual problem. I can see that.
Okay.
And so at what point do you think Jesus would have drawn that boundary where it's like, well, this is the point at which I can now retaliate or resist or not lay down my life? Do you think he had any boundaries, or do you think he totally gave back to God? Yes. what was due to God?
I think that he had some personal boundaries, and the cleansing of the temple would be a real good example.
Right. But I think he did it in a way in which, you know, he wasn't going to be conflictual with the character and the nature of God. So it was never going to be out of violence or maliciousness or hatred. It was just out of giving God back his tabernacling space. But yeah, I don't think there's any boundary that I can say would draw me out of my kingdom citizenship. Go ahead, Jerry. Let's see, I can tell you what to say something.
Okay. This comes to my mind. The government requires us to pay our taxes. It does not require us to approve of what they do with our taxes. However, if we do not pay our taxes, then the government has every right to come back and say, you owe us that, and you will or there will be this punishment. And I think it's like when you give somebody, okay, let's say that I give you $100. Now, you can accept that, and then it's yours and it's not mine because I gave it to you. Now, what you do with that $100, I have no control over because it's yours now. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the way I see that government thing. They say, pay your taxes. I say, okay, because I'm a law-abiding citizen, I pay my taxes. Now, what the government chooses to do with my taxes, I have no control over. That's just a thought.
Right. And I think that totally speaks to the question that they're posing to Jesus. And he says, give it back. That's what he says. He says, if it's got Caesar's inscription and his image on it, give it back to him. But make sure you're giving back to God what is God's. That's the way he handles the question.
To me, Eric, I don't want to take us too far on a different tangent, but it feels very similar to the idea that we talked about before of who we give our grace to. It specifically came up when we were talking about the homeless. This was probably a year ago. And we don't have control over what is then used in turn with the grace that we give to others. I mean, the conversation then was about homeless, but that could be applied to anyone of who we offer grace to. What they do with that grace is not of our concern. What we are commanded to do is to show grace.
Right. And I think that's exactly the point of giving back to God is what is God's. You know, you act in a way in which God acts, and you know, you really have no control over how others respond to that.
Hey, Eric, with that point about grace, look at the grace that God has given to us and what we often do or don't do with it, how we squander it, how we waste it, how we don't share it. And he still gives it to us over and over and over.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Amen. And I'll add with that, you know, we speak of, you know, a government then doing grievous things with maybe the taxes that we pay. Well, how would God view the grievous way we trample on his good grace? Right. And so if we say, well, we can stop paying taxes because the government does all these bad things with our money, then we have to agree God should stop giving us grace because we do grievous things with his grace.
Right.
And I don't think any of us are willing to say that.
Right. Yeah. I think it's a double standard of sorts, you know, like, because we are such bad stewards with God's grace, you know, it's hard to judge other people for being, bad stewards with the funds that we give them that Jesus is saying is theirs. You know, just give it back to them. After you do that, it's the only thing you can control is giving back to them what belongs to them and giving back to God what belongs to God.
And we could waste a lot of time trying to figure out if we should give the taxes back or withhold whatever.
Right.
And we have better and higher things that we should be doing with our time. Mm-hmm. So just give it and get on with the work that is God's, given back to God in that our work and our service in fruitfulness.
Right. And I think that's what I get from this teaching.
Hey, Eric?
Yeah. Go ahead, Otis.
Eric, yeah, I'll take it in a slightly different direction. Are we reading into this or gaining an insight from this parable that the relationship that Jesus points out, the relationship between the coin that is minted by the government and the government itself, is the same kind of useful relationship between the Christian and God? In other words, total ownership. Could that be an insight that we can read into this?
That are you saying that the person who minted the coin has total ownership over the individual, just like God who minted the person has ownership over the individual?
In short terms, yes, so that the listening audience would understand that there is the duty of obedience, the duty of submission. Can we read that much into it?
I would not. I would say that, you know, how I understand it, take that for what it's worth. That God requires everything, total allegiance, total obedience. He is the only kingdom that you should truly and ultimately belong to. And if you're living within, you know, a kingdom here on earth that is requiring your taxes from you, then you pay those back without compromising your citizenship in the kingdom of God. If your country is demanding you, this is just my personal application, and you know, this, take that for what it's worth, Otis. If my country is demanding me to go to war and fight for my country and their freedom, I will do that in a way in which doesn't compromise my kingdom citizenship. And so, you know, this is just me, but I could not, you know, I could not uphold that calling of being drafted to war in a way in which I would take another man's life. Like, I would have to find a way I could do that. Maybe be a medic, maybe be a, you know, do something within that calling that aligns with God's kingdom. And so, I don't know if you've seen the movie Hacksaw Ridge. Have you seen that movie, Otis?
Yes.
The medic who refuses to carry a gun and to kill other men, but says because of his faith, he will live out the kingdom's calling, his nation's calling, but he will do it in a way in which he can go and save dozens and dozens of lives to glorify God. And so that way he's not giving back
out of God's.
Yeah, in a way that compromises his kingdom citizenship.
Yeah, I understand. And that's a good answer. That does answer my first question also. I'm back at the point of thinking that we are indeed required to think as individual Christians. So, yeah, makes sense. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
I think, Otis, what your first comment there, with the coin minted by the government belongs to the government, we owe that. And I think it was kind of stated already that we are basically minted from God. So as we owe the coinage to the government, we owe our complete self to God. I think, is that kind of what you were stating at first with that?
Yes, that kind of sort of makes sense. But we have to realize it's a timeless document. You know, what our Lord said is timeless guidance. And if we apply this today to what we have, it's quite a bit of a different situation than what they had in the first century. So at this point, I'd prefer to just leave it at that.
Cool. Dorothy, did I in any way expound upon your question or not?
No, I was just wondering if we're supposed to give ourselves completely to God, is there room within our lives to be a patriotic person that I don't exactly know how to put it.
I would say you absolutely could be, you know, patriotic, just as long as it's not going to cause you not to give back to God what belongs to Him, which is your total self. But I think you can totally be patriotic and supportive. But I think it can't be like a blind, no allegiance. You know, I mean, I think there's going to be maybe some things that you can't always totally agree with just because it's of your country. But I don't think it's wrong to be patriotic at all. I would just say, as long as you're doing it in a way in which aligns with God's character and the image that he's minted you to be, which is just like his son.
Yeah. But the other thing, I guess maybe another way that I'm thinking about it is, what about being political? I mean, that's a whole nother issue that I'm not sure if a Christian should be involved in politics. Because
I would say it's going to be a very, there's a lot of individuality there. I mean, I would say if you could be involved in a way in which you can cause redemption and betterment of the world, I mean, I would think it is to be, for you to live in a way in which you're giving back to God what is his, like that would be your duty and your calling. As long as it's not causing you to compromise that priority citizenship, which is of the kingdom of heaven, kingdom of God.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Eric, just a thought with that question, you know, when we're thinking about, can we be political or patriotic? I mean, another way of phrasing that is, should we have an allegiance to other entities other than God? And I think the reality is that's kind of a given in our lives. We have allegiance to our family. We have allegiance to our job. We have allegiance to so many things, but at which point those allegiances supersede our allegiance to God is when it becomes the problem. And to take it back to the very beginning of this conversation, that's when it becomes an idol. That's when that coin becomes an idol more than what God is expecting of us.
Yep. That's exactly what I've been trying to say. Of course, you just said it more eloquently than I can, but I'm used to that. If there's nothing else, we're going to move on to the next section, which is going to get even more, I don't know,
hairy.
Yeah, maybe so. Anything else before we move on?
Come on, Eric, take a side here.
Yeah, right. Can't do it just because of what, can't do it. 23 through 33, if you don't care, Andy.
The same day, Sadducees came to him who say there is no resurrection, and they ask him a question saying, "Teacher, Moses said if a man dies having no children, his brother must marry the widow and raise up offspring for his brother. Now there were seven brothers among us. The first married and died, and having no offspring, left his wife to his brother. So to the second and third, down to the seventh. After them, all the woman died. In the resurrection, therefore, of the seven, whose wife will she be? For they all had her." But Jesus answered, "You are wrong because you know neither the scripture nor the power of God. For in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. And as for the resurrection of the dead, you have not read that what was said to you by God, 'I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob.' He is not God of the dead, but God, but of the living." And when the crowd heard it, they were astonished at his teaching.
All right. So I want to point out that, you know, it's the same day in verse 23. It's the same day, another group, not the Herodians, not the Pharisees, but this time the Sadducees come to him, and they're going to ask him a question to pretty much do the same thing that the last group did, to entangle him, to make him look foolish, to divide him from other certain parties. And I think it's important to point out that Jesus acknowledges that they do not know the scriptures, that they are, they're going to look to a certain passage or a certain group of scriptures to make their point or to disprove their point, but they have no true knowledge of God's scripture and his authority. All they can do is pick out a verse or a few to make the point that they want to make, to try to show that their opinion aligns with God's opinion. And Jesus says, "You are wrong. You don't know what you're talking about because you don't know the scriptures and you don't know the power of God." And so I want to really identify what the question is as well as the main subject that the Sadducees are proposing. In verse 24, notice how many times they talk about these men. If a man dies and doesn't have any children, well, his brother must marry the widow and raise up offspring for his brother, for the other man. Now, if there were seven brothers among us, the first married and died and had no offspring, left his wife to his brother, and two, the second and the third down to the seventh, after them all, the woman finally died. In the resurrection, therefore, of the seven, whose wife will she be? For they all had her. And so what they're not asking Jesus is whether there will be a marriage relationship in heaven. What they're asking is, whose man of these seven men, whose property and whose possession will this woman be?
Hierarchy again.
Yeah, it is a hierarchy. But it's also a way of taking possession and taking ownership of a human and just seeing them totally as just your property.
And so
it doesn't seem like Jesus is answering the question of whether or not there will be like a marriage relationship or a covenantal relationship in heaven, like a special one-on-one relationship, which really made me think through what was going on in Genesis 1, where man and God have this unique relationship with each other in this heaven and earth space. And even though man there has this unique personal relationship with God, it's still not good that man's alone, even though he has God in that perfect creation that God allowed him to be in. It was still not good that this man didn't have a significant other. And so I want to really identify the answer in the main subject for Jesus. So in verse 29, Jesus says, "You're wrong because you don't know the scriptures and you don't know the power of God. For in the resurrection, they neither marry, they're neither taken in marriage, nor are they given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven." So I really want to bring out like the subject of that verse, of verse 30. For in the resurrection, they, which is the people, and what I would see is the women, especially the wife, they're neither going to be taken in marriage, they're not for you to take, and they're not going to be given in marriage, which takes it back to the previous teaching, like, you know, give back to God what is God's. They're not going to be taken or given in marriage, but they are like angels in heaven. They're not property. They're not for possession, but they have the ability to choose who they're going to be in a unique relationship where they become one. It's not that, you know, the brothers have ownership over this woman to do as they wish and pass her down just to preserve their own names. But the woman is going to have as much of a say in this new resurrection relationship as the man. They are going to be equal with the man in whether or not they desire to be in a unique, eternal relationship with somebody else. Before I keep going, this to me, I really had to think through all of this because, you know, I'd always seen this verse used as validation of other people's opinions that there would be no marriage in heaven. I just see myself being one of the Sadducees that Jesus is saying, like, you don't know the scriptures or the power of God. Why do you think there won't be any marriage in heaven? Now, there won't be any taking in marriage. There won't be any giving in marriage once you're in the resurrection. But I don't think that disqualifies a personal, unique relationship where you have dedicated your life to becoming one, and then God is going to say, I'm going to split that unity. I'm going to divide this unique relationship that you've worked on for your entire life and dedicated yourself to. And I don't think that means that, you know, you're going to be required to have any kind of personal, significant relationship. But I think, you know, if that's something you have given yourself to and you desire in a way in which images God, you know, gives back to God what is his. I don't see, just from this teaching at least, that that's not something that's going to take place. And
I just don't think what you're saying is you don't think it teaches either way about that. This is not speaking to that.
To whether or not we will have
marriage,
personal relationships,
right,
and resurrection.
Right.
I don't think that's the question, and I don't think that's the answer. Yeah. No, I don't think it's either one, the question or the answer.
Which I always felt it was.
Right.
Eric? I see what you're saying. So.
Go ahead.
This is Steve. You know, they're applying an earthly situation, marriage, to a heavenly situation, and to try to compare the two is kind of a bizarre thing to try to do in the first place. And this is one of those what if questions that, you know, sometimes you can't give a complete answer to. But when Jesus answers it, he mentions angels here. Right. And our nature too will be, as I understand, angels are eternal. And in the nature of the question here, as earthly situation, it was to progenerate, and that's not an applicable purpose, reason, or has any rhyme to it in heaven. Trying to compare the two just doesn't mesh. How else I can say that, I don't know. But, you know, angels are eternal. When we are there, we will be eternal
and spiritual.
And spiritual. And to ask this question, it's based on an earthly situation, and you can't bring that into the play here.
Yeah, and I think what he's really disputing is the Levirate marriage relationship, where it is like it's not a personal like this woman desire to be with you know, the sixth brother. It's no, you know, they have an obligation based on this Levirate marriage that wasn't even part of God's ideal. God's ideal was that Adam would live in the eternal nature in the heavenly space, which God created, with his eternal wife, and that they would exist in this heaven and this heaven and earth creation eternally and always as God's children. But of course it didn't play out that way. But yeah,
you know, what else here is that they were supposed to be experts in the books of Moses. If Moses didn't write it, they didn't study it, they didn't believe it. So he's pointing out, Jesus is, that you really don't know the books of Moses, which you kind of claim to be the all authority on. So right. That's kind of something he's also bringing out to them and hitting them with.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead, Jerry.
Okay. I have one thought on this. Our earthly marriages, which are covenantal, as you have used that word, I think it's a great word to use here. And once we enter into marriage, we have a responsibility to our mate, a responsibility to stay faithful to that mate. And the Bible clearly teaches that that lasts until one or the other dies, and then that other person can marry again. Now, saying that, It would seem to me, kind of in accordance with what Steve was saying here, that that allegiance, that relationship that we have on earth to our husband or wife fades so completely in our heavenly relationship with God when we are literally in his presence and with him. I have a hard time seeing that that once physical relationship even really plays into our heavenly life once we are there. I think it's sort of like, you know, when someone you love dies and that person is not a Christian, I have often wondered, how can you enjoy heaven if you know that person is not there? But I've decided that's faulty reasoning. God wants me to be happy in heaven. He wants me to experience eternal bliss. And if that's the way of it, then whatever it is right now that bothers me is not going to bother me in heaven. And that's sort of the way I see the marriage thing. I just think it's not going to be important. I think we're going to be so glad to be there and to be in the presence of God and to share with the angels. It's not going to matter. And that's my soapbox.
Yep. I've always kind of held that position until I really started thinking about Adam doing all of that and God still saying it's not good for him to be by himself. You know, even though he's in God's presence, even though he's you know, inhabiting the heavenly space, God still didn't see it as good that he was alone. And I don't think that means that you have to have a significant other. I think the Bible teaches that, you know, if you don't have the need for that, it's a good thing. I think the teaching is that the women will have as much of a say in the resurrection as the men when it comes to eternal relationships. I mean, I think relationships will still exist. And like you're saying, like, you know, that's about as far as I can take it. I really have no other anything past that other than just my opinion.
And I think it makes sense because what you're saying is in verse 30, the indirection, that's both men and women.
Right.
And then, you know, at points in that old way of thinking and how people got married, it says they neither marry, so that'd be deciding to marry, or are given to marriage, that'd be like an arranged marriage. So all of these are both for men or women at that time. And in their custom, it wouldn't have been that way for women at all.
Right.
They generally didn't decide when and where they would marry, and they not and to whom they would marry either. They were given away, and a dowry was paid for them. They were purchased,
right?
And like you said, their property. So it makes more sense to me that this is, even though it says they, and would refer to both the men and women, it really, after that, the structure of the sentence more points to the opposite of what would happen to a female in that day and time. And contrast that with what it's going to look like in heaven.
Right. And I think he's clearly saying that there will be no more taking in marriage or giving in marriage in the resurrection. But you will be immortal like the angels in heaven. Well, it doesn't say immortal here, but it does in Luke's account of this. But you will be like the angels. You will be immortal in heaven. And so, yeah, the woman is going to have as much of a say in who she wants to exist with. And it's not going to be based on a contract that she made with this guy's brother six brothers ago. If she doesn't desire to be in a relationship, she's not going to be forced to participate. She's not bound to a contractual relationship. But yeah, I think it's, to me, it's significant when you read it carefully that he says, for in the resurrection, they, being the subject, neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels. And then the next verse he says, and as for the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what it said to you by God? And now it seems that he's talking about the resurrection more generally. Now it's not so much about the people who are resurrected, but as for the general resurrection of the dead, have you not read what it was said to you by God? You know, they were saying, this is what Moses said. And now Jesus is saying, well, what God said was, and not just God said, God saying it to you, like presently, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He's not the God of the dead, but of the living. And when Eric, the God was, you were astonished at his teaching.
Hey, Eric, this is Terry.
Yeah.
It's my understanding that the Sadducees, they did not believe in a resurrection at all.
Correct.
That most of them were wealthy and really didn't need anything. So they really didn't believe in the resurrection at all. But they were kind of trying to trap Jesus into admitting that. And the Sadducees only believed in the Torah. And that's the reason Jesus goes back and quotes Deuteronomy
23, 25:5. Yeah, but the Levirate marriage.
Yeah, instead of going to the one of the prophets, he went back to the Torah because that's what they believed in.
Right. Yeah, that's where they're getting that. That's where they're getting that contractual, you know, relationship obligation between these brothers. You know, that they must take this woman and raise up offspring for the sake of their dead brother. And yeah, Dorothy, I think he's totally saying that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they're not dead, but they are still living. They haven't been resurrected yet, of course. You know, in the resurrection, their bodies will be raised from the ground. But yeah, they are still living in God's face. They're just waiting for their resurrection bodies, like everyone else that's dead, except for those who were raised on the day Jesus died. There were a few, and I don't know what to make of that. But other than Jesus and those other few on the day of Jesus's death when the tombs were opened, nobody else has been resurrected, but they are still living. If there's nothing else, I'm going to turn it over to Randy and let Ryan clear this up next week.